Just as we have Catholics and Protestants in the Christian world, we have, you know, quite a few what you call persuasions in Islam, the Shias, the Sunnis, the Kharijis, the Sufis. And within the Sunni, you have madhabs like, you know, the Shafi, the Hanbali, the Maliki, and the Hanafi. And within the Sufis as well, you have tariqas, turuq, like the Naqshbandi, you know, and the Chisti, the Shadili. And within the Shia as well, we have quite a few groups, especially three groups that I can tell you about is the Zaydis, the Ibn Asharis, and the Ismailis. So this is how, you know, that is where Ismailis stand within the framework of Islam, which is itself Ahl al-Kitab, you know, the Abrahamic tradition of which you are talking about. So with that, then I'll start on the Ismaili spirituality. The title of my paper is Articulation of Shi'i Ismaili Spirituality. A very distinguished Western scholar of Shi'i studies, Henry Corbin, refers to the Ismaili tradition as the exponent par excellence of esoteric gnosis in Islam. I shall, however, qualify that statement and say that in fact the essence of all traditions is its spirituality. Spirituality can mean different things to different people, although it is hardly debatable when viewed from a metaphysical standpoint. In Arabic, spirituality is ruhaniya, from ruh, spirit, rather than from soul, psyche, or nafs. The spirit, or ruh, in man is also referred to as al-hakika, the reality, or al-sir, the secret. In the Quran, aql is also called a ruh. This intellect is veiled behind the discursive thought or reason and is essentially the same as the divine intellect. Aql, intellect, is the faculty in man which is the embodiment of being or spirit. It is this which sets him apart from animals, entitling him to the status of Khalifatullahi, vicegerent of God on earth. What I understand by spirituality is the development of one's inner self, the unfolding of one's inner purity, and the realization of one's true potential. This is the remit of all faiths, and in fact the eventual esteem in which most religious figures are held is due to the commendable work they did on their own selves, their patience and selflessness, their generosity of character, their magnanimity towards people who hurt them. Their constant forgiving nature was that which won the admiration and affection of the people. The charisma in their personalities sprang from their fearlessness, which in itself is a sign of an enlightened spirit. In Islam, that figure is Muhammad, and any serious, profound thinker will realize that there is far more to the Quran than the apparent text itself that has come down to us with its hudud, the commands and the prohibitions. The Shi'i Ismaili spirituality, as I understand it, therefore, is inextricably linked to the inexplicable spiritual phenomena experienced by Muhammad and communicated in the Shia tradition by Ali to his followers, enabling them to understand and emulate this unique truth. Ali's unique gift, miraculous ability, and remarkable powers lay in showing people the way to the truth by preparing them appropriately to receive the grace. Ali is considered the fountainhead of esoteric knowledge in Islam, being the adept in ta'wil or hermeneutics of the Quran, preserved in the form of both oral and written traditions. Ali's profound knowledge of the esoteric and the exoteric interpretations is clearly evident from the early sources. But for the Shia, he is the supreme and preeminent Wali. Wali, in my opinion, is an intimate friend of the God, a preeminent Wali, whose love for God was pure, unconditional, and unadulterated, arising not from the tortures of hell, nor from pleasures of paradise, Ali was simply and utterly intoxicated by the love of God, fearful only of being cut off from the presence of God. This then is the meaning and essence of Shi'i Haqiqa. That is the reality of being a Shia of Ali, i.e. of losing oneself in the essence of God. The method of achieving this reality or this real destiny is knowledge of one's own self, one's own worth, exemplified in a prophetic tradition reported by Ali that he who knows his self knows his Lord. Man arafa nafsahu faqad arafa rabbahu. Scholars and mystics alike from all persuasions, be it Shi'i, Sufi or Sunni, have used this particular tradition. To know one's innermost heart is to discover the point at which the divine is found as the meeting point of the human and the divine. The Quranic verse, "We shall show them our signs on the horizons and within themselves," is interpreted as God's command to look deep down in the inner recesses of one's heart to find the source of knowledge and eventually the divine beloved who is closer to oneself than his jugular vein. This tradition of knowing oneself is usually a synopsis of the mystical experience, an inner journey into one's heart. And heart, which is qalb in Arabic, the loving heart, the qalb, is the dwelling place of God, encapsulated in another tradition, heaven and earth contain me not, but the heart of my faithful worshipper contains me. That the heart is the mirror in which God reflects himself is certain, but the heart needs to be purified in order to reflect the primordial divine light. In the time of the Prophet and Ali, this purity was epitomized by Salman al-Farisi, whom Muhammad accorded a unique status of being one of his family, addressing him endearingly, Salman min ahl al-bayti, means Salman is from my house. The ultimate wish and desire of all believers is to attain that status and rank, which obviously was one of the spirit rather than of the physic. This spirituality is also explicit as a process in the teachings and aphorisms that have come down to us from Ali's descendants, especially Al-Baqir and his son Ja'far al-Sadiq. Knowledge was a central theme in the teachings of Al-Baqir and al-Sadiq, and a duty for all Muslims to acquire through aql or intellect. For Al-Baqir and Ja'far al-Sadiq, the aql is that supreme faculty by which God is worshipped and through which the knowledge of good and evil is acquired. This knowledge in turn teaches people, among other things, how to struggle against one's own lower tendencies in order to purify the self. Al-Baqir's and al-Sadiq's views on the imamate, therefore, and those on aql, ilm, amal and iman were therefore geared towards self-actualization. The concern for personal ethics and morality as well as individual communion with God found specially in Ja'far al-Sadiq's thought is thus to obtain that receptivity in the heart and mind which he sometimes refers to as ma'arifa, not to be confused with the usage later on. For the Shia, therefore, besides building an impressive edifice of Shi'i law and theology, the imams also played the role of a spiritual guide in initiating followers into the inner parts of knowledge and wisdom, knowledge that is experiential and realized in the believer's heart. As with Ali, an important aspect of Ja'far al-Sadiq's thought was therefore a search for haqiqa in the revelation, and his teachings certainly reveal the Shi'i vision as the esoteric aspect of Islam. The crux of his teaching is undoubtedly the concept of imama, which perceives the perpetual need of an authoritative teacher for mankind who is both divinely guided and infallible. The amana or the trust which the imam undertakes from God renders him a hujjah, a guarantor, and a link or a sabab with the celestial world for the individuals who accept his authority. This authority of the imam is part of the universal history which begins with the pre-creation covenant, the Yawm al-Mithaq, manifested through the chain of prophets and their legatees. The imam's task is therefore man's purification in order to prepare appropriate receptacles for the haqiqah, which is the real meaning of history, restoring man to his original abode. Ja'far's spirituality was therefore not simply an escapism, but a genuine desire to articulate and express his experience for others to recognize and emulate it. This was his role as the imam, to help others achieve this ma'rifa kalbiya, cognition of the heart. And this ma'rifa is channeled and communicated to the believers by the imam, who helps the faithful achieve the truth or haqiqa. What we come across in Al-Baqir and As-Sadiq was how the faculty of intellect is used in acquiring knowledge to improve the amal or the actions of the individual, who through refining his nature eventually achieves the ma'rifa kalbiya, the cognition of the heart. And it is obvious that no transformation is possible without the desire for the quest itself. And this ardent, passionate yearning is described in a very brilliant risala of the Ikhwan al-Safa, and the risala is called the Risalatul Ishq, which is the risala of the divine love, and which I'm going to describe in a little synopsis. So this ardent, passionate desire is what the Ikhwan al-Safa relate in a treatise of on divine love. They describe that the true beloved is God, whom all created beings yearn for. And this passionate or intense love or ishq has been variously defined as junoon ilahi or divine madness, or by some of the people as mard nafsani, as illness of the soul. But the hukama or the sages say that ishq is that love which has conquered the self, or yet others define it very correctly as the most intense longing for union with God. Qualifying this union, the Ikhwan al-Safa are saying that it is, of course, the union of the soul rather than the body. And the Ikhwan al-Safa differentiate between three levels that exist within the human soul. And they call it the nafs an-nabatiya al-shahwaniya, which is the greedy vegetative or plant soul that is interested only in eating, drinking, and reproducing. And then they talk about the nafs al-ghadabiya al-haywaniya, which is the animal indignant soul interested in controlling and overpowering and subduing people. And then there is the nafs an-natika, which is the rational thinking soul whose love is inclined towards knowledge and acquisition of virtues. And what the Ikhwan say is that no human being is free of these three aspects. We all have it in some measure. Some have it less and some more. Then they go on to describe the various types of love that are present in the world and conclude that affection and love in the world are the most priceless aspects in the creation, without which all virtues would remain hidden and without which vices would not become apparent. And then he talks about, then they talk about the different attachments which the soul has, depending on their stages of knowledge and the degree of their cognition. And therefore they say that this means that the greedy soul would not obviously be inclined towards control, nor would the animal soul be inclined towards the sciences and the knowledge. Similarly, an angelic soul, which is the rational soul, the rational thinking soul, is not attracted to the physical, material aspects, but wishes to detach itself from the body and ascend to the heavenly sky and lose itself in the celestial spheres enjoying the fragrance of the spirit. It is the animal soul that is always craving to subdue and control and subjugate others rather than his own self, and being vindictive and hurtful when others hurt him without feeling any guilt. So the Ikhwan then go on to describe that the perfect state is that of the Ruh al-Natika, always being aware of the reality of things, imagining them, experiencing abundant joy and happiness. And the Ruh al-Natika is therefore attracted to the sciences and the cognition of knowledge. Inner images inside, drawing it and pulling it and propelling it towards perfecting its virtues and directing it to achieve its objective. And the most excellent of that objective is to incline towards his creator. This is described, they say, in the Quran, where the Quran alludes to this in saying that Allahina amanu ashaddu hubban lillahi, that you know, those who believe have the most intense love for God, that is loving God more than anyone else. The highest aim of the divine love or ishq is obviously to arise from the slumber of negligence and ignorance. Talking about human love, they describe that those who have experienced a period of parting from their loved ones may have realized that the images and impressions that they used to see in their near ones are actually embedded in their own souls. They are inscribed in their own souls and impressed upon their own substance and represented in the essence of their own selves, permanently etched in themselves. The Ikhwan then advised that if an intelligent and sensible individual were to reflect upon it and awaken his soul from the negligence and slumber of ignorance, conquer the substance of his soul from negligence, conquer the substance of his self and become self-reliant, managing without others in that sense of the word, then his soul would attain the serenity and the tranquility and the composure, relieving itself from the fatigue and distress and suffering of human relationships and overcoming the sickness that exists in those who just love the body and pine away for worldly attachments. This then is what the Ikhwan al-Safa said. What I'm going to do is to talk about a couple of, what I've done is to say what is spirituality and how we attain spirituality, not from what I gather, but from the sources that are available in the Ismaili, the Shi'i Ismaili tradition. So far what I have done is to talk about the early period, and I talked about Ali and Imam Bakir and Jafar al-Sadiq, and then I went on to the pre-Fatimid period and extracted information from the Ikhwan al-Safa. And what I'm now going to do is to talk to you about a couple of texts from the Fatimid period, and then probably a couple of sessions, a couple of snippets from the contemporary period. So from the Fatimid times, and there are numerous texts, I mean, I could probably be here until the cows come home if I were to go on from, you know, and talk about all the Ismaili literature that is, but I would like to really talk about the one which Henri Corbin picked up, and that was the Kitab al-Alim wal-Ghulam, the book of the master and the disciple, which is a very esoteric text. It is also a very literary text in the sense, but I will bring in the aspect which Henri Corbin brought out and talk to you briefly about it. This text has been recently translated and critically edited. The tahqiq and translation has been done by Professor James Morris of Exeter. But I'm going to be relying more on the analysis done by Henri Corbin, because it is more esoteric and probably where I'm more inclined in this kind of address. Henri Corbin speaks about the master and the disciple when he refers to the esotericism and the word. And he talks about the lost word, which is, you know, and he speaks of the tragedy common to all Abrahamic faiths and describes this tragedy as the tragedy of the lost word. He equates the quest for the Imam as the quest for the Holy Grail, or the white horseman of the apocalypse as understood by Swedenborg. Swedenborg has got a book on Swedenborg and the esoteric Islam. Because, he says, Henry Corbin says, because the imam in the Shi'i sense is both the conveyor and the content of the esoteric meaning, and therefore he is known as the Quran al-Natiq, as opposed to the Quran al-Samit. And without the imam, Henry Corbin says, that the word would be lost and there would be no one to resuscitate the spiritually dead. The text itself, the Kitab al-Alim wal-Ghulam, is a story of initiation between the master and the disciple, who eventually becomes a teacher himself and then searches for a pupil on whom he can pass on the legacy of what he has been graced with. And this continues as what he has been blessed with is not his own property. To use his own words in the text, I was myself dead. God brought me to life and made me one who knows. Arif, and it falls to me now to show my gratitude for this divine grace by transmitting to those who will follow the legacy with which I have been entrusted, al-amana, just as those who came before me have transmitted it to me. Now the interesting thing about Henry Corbin and how he relates this Kitab al-Alim wal-Ghulam is that he says that this story is not a narrative just for the Ismailis, but it can be equally applicable to any faith, because he says that it demonstrates the gradual awakening of the esoteric content of the tradition, and it recognizes the fact that the legacy of the prophet is continued in the lineage of the imams, who are the awliya Allah, and they are, because they are able to explain the spiritual esoteric content of the revelation, which in the Ismaili Tawil is called the Ismaili Gnosis. And I think I'm going to skip on quite a few pages. I'm not sure how many minutes do I have. About 10? 5 minutes for the prayer, yes. So I'll finish in 5 minutes and then the 5 minute prayer. Okay, personally, I mean, there is still quite a lot. I've only talked about the Fatimid and given you a text. Then there is the Alamut period where we have the Haftabab and the there is a wonderful book called the Fasl al-Bayan, Shanakhat al-Imam, and numerous other works. But I myself, my parents are from the Indian subcontinent, and where we were brought up in the Gnan tradition. And the Gnan tradition is, Gnan means gnosis. And that tradition is a very, it's about the devotional lyrics, just like you have the lyrics, and I love the, you know, the hymns of the Christian tradition. Ismailis have a tradition very similar. It's called the Gnan tradition, and I can encapsulate one quatrain about the Gnan tradition, and you can judge for yourself how spiritual that is. The Gujarati form, it is called Kheti Boiye Premki Ane Pani Dije Gnan Noor Tajalli Ful Phale Jo Lage Piyasu Dhyan. Plant the seeds of love in your heart and water them with divine knowledge. The epiphanic light will blossom or manifest in your heart when concentration reaches its peak with the beloved. That is just an encapsulation from one of the quatrain of the Gnan tradition. And of course there are many, many devotional lyrics whose aim is, of course, ethical and moral exhortation with a view to inculcating a sense of detachment, yet not totally abandoning the world, but a detached kind of philosophy, which even in the recent like personal development, if you read Susan Jeffers or Stephen Covey or Deepak Chopra or anyone, they talk about this aspect of detachment and not to expect anything. So this is the same kind of detachment which we find in the Gnan tradition, and it is then that you cultivate the love in your heart, which eventually generates the manifestation of light when you truly concentrate. The contemporary teachings then, in 2 or 3 minutes, the contemporary teachings of our especially the last two imams, Imam Karim Aga Khan and his grandfather Aga Khan III, they are constantly exhorting the followers to remember not only the duality of the life, the spiritual and the material, but also the transient nature of this existence, and that whatever one does on this earth will have to be accounted for. And therefore it is for this reason preparation must be made and sufficient time must be devoted to spiritual understanding, to spiritual elevation, so that when the time comes to go to this other world, one is better prepared. Ismailis are constantly reminded that from the time of the Prophet, certain prayers were mandatory and compulsory upon all Muslims of the time. But the Prophet is also known to have encouraged prayers at other times, to have at all times one's mind and thoughts close to Allah, thinking about Allah, so that one's faith is an integral part of the everyday life. For the Shias, this is, of course, a voluntary matter for each individual. And in this esoteric part, besides the external forms and practices of one's faith, one seeks through spiritual elevation to carry in one's heart the light of Imamat and thereby accede to the higher light. And this becomes a duty of each spiritual child. One in the Ismaili tradition is encouraged to alleviate all worldly matters when they are concentrating and meditating, and whatever else is happening around you in your daily lives. And it is through the concentration of thoughts, and if I can personally just say that there was a lady, you know, and I met this lady in a conference on alternative dispute resolution, and an English lady who told me that, Arzina, it's not only about talking to God, it is about listening to God, and therefore to close down the internal chatter so that you can dig deep down into the inner recesses and listen to what God is telling you, what the wisdom is from within. Ismailis, of course, are not alone in practicing this esoteric form of Islam. In this practice of the esoteric form, it is the Imam who shows the path to the to murids, to spiritual children who come to him. Exoteric means that which is visible, and which seeks to go no further than that which is visible. The Shia Ismailis belong to what you call the esoteric, and therefore, apart from the religious obligations which they all have, each individual, if he so wishes, can seek from the Imam guidance on how to practice his faith more personally when he has the time and the freedom to do so, to seek spiritual happiness and spiritual enlightenment. And in conclusion, therefore, the Shi'i Ismaili spirituality, as indeed all spirituality, is to do with the personal growth of the individual to transcend the lower self and gradually begin the journey towards the higher self, and hope that we all arrive one day at our original home. Thank you.